Welcome to Furry Explained. I'm Finn, a big black cat from the internet, and Furry Explained is my show about furries and their culture. First of all, before we get started, I do want to say that it does feel good to be back. The break for the holidays was much enjoyed, and I hope you also had a nice holiday season, but I missed having the show be a part of my routine, and if you're listening to this, thanks for sticking around even after such a long break. But we are back, and the furry fandom is still very much a thing, though lately it seems to be obsessed with one thing in particular. There have been a couple of movies that have come out in the past few months, and one of the particularly popular and actually very successful ones was Puss in Boots: The Last Wish. And if you listen to my bonus episode about furry movies, it should be no surprise that I went out and saw it myself. This checked all the boxes for a great new addition to the furry movie archive. Great animation based on an already well-established world of fantasy, a funny and easy-to-follow storyline, and, oh, lest I forget, great anthro-animal characters. But there was one character in particular that seemed to captivate the minds of furries throughout the fandom, the antagonist of the film that really was at the core of the entire story itself. That character was Death, or Death Wolf, the tall, hooded gray wolf that, without spoiling too much, whose name was a recurring theme throughout the film. And for some reason, furries absolutely fell in love with this character. The amount of memes, fan art, and just general discourse about Death has been the most I've seen online since Nick Wilde when Zootopia came out. And I have a theory about the reasoning why I think furries get so enamored by well-written antagonists that they don't know what to do with themselves, but that's not really the point of this particular episode. I am more interested in the phenomenon of those characters going viral in the first place. Why, every so often, an anthro-animal from a film or TV show or video game or some other form of media absolutely makes furries go wild. And that's what we're going to go over today. In this episode, we're going to take a look at the concept of furry bait and why such a thing exists. We'll give a more formal definition of what separates a character from being furry bait or not, and we'll also try to figure out how purposeful the act of putting these types of anthropomorphic animal characters in media that we consume actually is. And just for the record, while I think he's one of the best antagonists of any animated movie I've seen, I don't think Death is all that hot. The whole notion that he's associated with, death, just doesn't do it for me. Now, we can have a conversation about the few seconds that a buff version of Puss was on the screen. You can reason with me there, but Death? He was alright at best. But I'm getting way too distracted by the looks of fictional characters, so let's get into the main point of this episode. Welcome to Furry Explained, and we'll get started right here. Alright, so let's get into it. What we're trying to do here is give a proper definition of what furry bait is. Because it may sound straightforward, but I believe some important qualifications must be met before regarding a specific anthropomorphic animal character as furry bait. To me, furry bait is a character, and anthropomorphic animal character at that, that has a certain set of features that grab the attention of members of the furry fandom or those adjacent to it. And it's those features that are important. For a character to be considered furry bait, it just can't be any random anthropomorphic animal. It has to possess one or many attributes that match the idea of a typical furry character. And while there's no definitive list of what those features are, there are a few that are pretty much table stakes for any character to have to include them in this conversation. There are three big ones that come to mind. The first one is that these characters have to be really rooted in fantasy. And not just the fantasy idea of talking animals, but set in a fantastical context and having characteristics that make the character not just anthropomorphized, but more like an animal with human attributes rather than a human with animal attributes. Secondly, and this one is kind of simple but still very important, the character has to be cool or interesting. Their existence in a specific setting has to not just be a means to an end. The character also has to have its own personality and reason for being, something that we as humans can identify and either be for or against or even somewhere in between. And finally, it really helps if a character has characteristics that furries tend to find, quote, attractive. Now, I wouldn't say that this one is absolutely necessary, but most characters that fall under this category have something nice about them that furries have an affinity for in their idealistic representations of anthropomorphic animals. It could be a nice voice, a nice body, or a certain sense of intellect or cunningness that members of the fandom might really like. I think this is where the bait part of furry bait really comes into play. The attractiveness of the character can be the differentiator between bait and just any other anthropomorphic animal character. Now, those examples were a bit high level, as they described more ideas of attributes, not actual examples that differentiate a character from bait or not. And we started out that way because furry bait is just one of those things where you know it when you see it. If you hang out in the fandom for long enough, you start to pick up not just what furries tend to be interested in, but also how some characters were really made with furries in mind. So, from my point of view, I think it's actually more helpful to look at examples from the opposite perspective and look at what makes a character not qualified to be furry bait. And I think the easiest group of characters that don't really qualify as furry bait are characters that are intrinsically tied to a larger corporation. In this case, I'm talking about things like company mascots that may very well be anthropomorphic animals, but not so much furry bait. Now, I apologize if most of the references I have are very American, it's the country I happen to live in, but if you think about examples like the Geico Gecko, the Nesquik Rabbit, or even Tony the Tiger from Frosted Flakes, all of those are anthropomorphic animals very much based in fantasy, but really don't have that true separate personality trait, other than trying to coax you to buy the brand that they're representing. Heck, the fandom really tried really hard to turn Tony the Tiger into a furry bait character, but that got so messy that there was actually resistance from Kellogg's themselves from having their mascot associated with the fandom in any direct way. But it's not just characters we see in commercials. There are a bunch of characters in the more general media that we consume that don't really qualify as furry bait either. For example, characters like Paddington, Winnie the Pooh, Mickey Mouse, and even the Cat in the Hat are never put in that conversation regarding furry bait. All of those characters are indeed anthro-animals, but still, something is missing about each of them that keeps them from making the cut. Paddington, and depending on which version of Cat in the Hat you're looking at, just look too realistic. Winnie the Pooh is ironically too wholesome, and Mickey is in that weird spot of half corporate mascot, half media character that really taints any qualities that furries might find truly redeeming. These are examples in contrast to characters like the aforementioned Nick Wilde from Zootopia, Legoshi from Beastars, and the guy we opened the show with, Death from Puss in Boots. Those are all anthro-animal characters based in fantasy, with actual personalities and things about them that make them individuals, and even have a little something that furries find attractive. Whether it be the smooth-talking fox that Nick is, the tall but cute and romantically awkward nature of Legoshi, or the intimidating and dominance that exudes from Death Wolf. All of those subtle attributes really add up to those characters really being regarded by most people in the fandom as furry bait. So that's the what part of furry bait. Again, it's really one of those things where you know it when you see it. But you know we like to dig just a little deeper into things about this fandom on this show, and I'm really interested in the reality of furry bait. That is, are these characters actually designed to, by nature of the very definition, bait furries into something? The idea of furry bait has always fascinated me personally because it's one of the concepts of the furry fandom that actually kind of goes against the general idea of what furry is. Being a furry is all about personal creativity and individualism. We all celebrate the general idea of anthropomorphic animals, and the personas that many members choose to make are unique and not seen anywhere else in the fandom. But when talking about the concept of furry bait, most furries point to characters established outside of the fandom, generated by a group of people that in most cases have some degree of separation away from the fandom. And that separation brings up an interesting question. Who is baiting whom with furry characters? Do the creators of these characters do so to coax people into the furry fandom? Or do furries use these characters as a way to relate to lay people about the hobby that they're interested in, with the implicit hope that they'll join as well? Honestly, I think it's a little bit of both, because there are really good reasons for both sides to be doing so. Let's start with the media franchises, large and small, that create furry bait characters in the things that they make. If you think about it, making things that cater to the furry audience is actually a very smart business move. The furry fandom is indeed niche, but it's not that niche, insofar as the size of the fandom is decently large and shows no signs of slowing in growth anytime soon. Also, because of the fandom's widespread appeal, furries are made up of people with a variety of different interests and demographics that may cover a wider base than other fandoms. Also, the fandom is intrinsically very social, and things go viral in this fandom specifically all of the time, all of which get more eyes, ears, or otherwise on the things that these media franchises are ultimately trying to sell. Furries might think it's all fun and games, but what the business behind the thing that is going viral sees is a bunch of free advertising, the most valuable type of advertising there is. Actually, I take that back. That's the second most valuable type of advertising there is. The actual most valuable type is when your product, in this case these anthropomorphic animal characters, becomes integrated into culture. And the whole idea of furry bait feeds into the culture of furries all of the time. And you can see this with the generation of memes of these characters, the ultimate form of expressing culture amongst a group. Furries take these characters and make new, unique, and additional content with them, not only just doing that free advertising that we talked about, but taking that advertising and giving it more cultural context, making it much more effective and more impressionable in the fandom itself. This in turn has many cascading second-order effects, a big one being the concept of the fear of missing out. Just seeing a character that is considered furry bait is one thing, but if you're seeing people joking about it, making memes of them, and using attributes of that character that only makes sense if you see it in the context of the media that it was originally portrayed in, you're going to be more inclined to watch that movie, read that book, or consume that media so that you can understand and participate in the meme discourse around that character. And I'm not saying any of this is a bad thing. If anything, it's a win-win for both sides. My point is, I don't think it's all that conspiratorial to believe that even large corporate media franchises make content that cater to furries. There are just too many business upsides to ignore this community. Now, the most common definition of furry bait does involve taking a character from a non-furry media franchise and using it as a way to attract furries into consuming their product, but there's also a smaller, more subtle use of the term, where the character is made just for furries to talk about. The bait, in this case, is more just to get furries to have fun with a certain expression of the idea of anthropomorphic animals, just done in a way that may be targeted for a wider general audience as well. This is almost the inverse of the first explanation of furry bait that we have, where furries and furry-adjacent folk know the core audience of what they're making is going to be other furries, but if taken out of that context, their work can also be enjoyed by non-furries alike. There is a lot of furry media, video games especially, that are made by furries but released for everyone to enjoy, and those who don't know any better are simply treated with complex and well-developed anthro-animal characters. Some are more direct bait than others, but even that is just furries making things for other furries, or the bait is intrinsically done for them. And sometimes furries and their culture make their way into a larger media franchise, where, with that knowledge, they can do a lot more specific targeting to the furry audience. For me, the biggest example that I will always go back to when talking about this is the release date of The Bad Guys on DVD and Blu-ray here in the United States. I've talked about this before, but it came out on June 21st, 2022, or 6-1, and you really cannot convince me that that wasn't done to get a ruckus out of the furry community. That's more than just a coincidence to me. But that is just one of the examples of furries baiting each other in this fandom, not to mention the characters that furries sort of adopt into this fandom as bait as well. I didn't go too far into this because the fandom's success rate of doing this is, I guess, decent at best, and sometimes falls hard on its face, see Tony the Tiger that we talked about earlier. But every once in a while, you'll see a character or a mascot get furrified to an extent that it becomes a part of the furry bait category. All of this is to say that I think it's a foregone conclusion that furry bait is definitely a real thing, and we're only going to see more of it going forward. The fandom is continuing to grow, and the risk-to-reward calculations will continue to favor reward for media franchises with that continued growth. And furries pretty much do all of the work for them. They will take that piece of anthropomorphic animal media and spread it like wildfire, adding their own furry-specific memes and culture to make it all that more valuable. That's not to say that it doesn't go too far sometimes, but much like most things in the fandom, it's all harmless fun, and more importantly, yet another thing that makes this fandom unique. So yeah, if you're a furry, don't be surprised if you see an increase of characters in the media that the fandom would consider furry bait in the very near future. Outsiders are starting to catch on to our value of creation, and in many ways, I really see that as quite the compliment. Alright, that concludes this episode of Furry Explained. Thank you so much for tuning in and listening. I really hope you enjoyed it and maybe learned something new today. As always, if you want to continue the conversation about furry bait or have any other suggestions or feedback for the show, you can find and follow me on Twitter. I'm at Finn the Panther, and a link to my Twitter is down in the show notes, along with some other stuff about furry bait that you should definitely check out. As always, if you do like the show and want to support it, the best way to do that is to follow or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. If you're on iTunes or Apple Podcasts or Spotify, be sure to give the show a rating and a review as well. You can also just tell people about the show, and if they don't know where to start looking, you can point them to pod.link/furryexplained to find the show on their platform of choice. Thank you so much for doing so, and we'll be back next time for another episode of Furry Explained, but until then, stay wild out there. Peace. Okay, I really didn't know where to put this, so I guess I'll say this right at the end here. I know I kind of announced the end of the show in the last thing that I posted in 2022, and I know there were some initial concerns about this show essentially dying, so I wanted to kind of address that quickly here. Because of the timing of some prerequisites still not being met yet, I'm still a little ways away from making that full transition to, I guess, the next era of my content creation, if you will, at least a few months off at best. So, in the meantime, I'll be making a few more normal furry explained episodes to fill that gap between now and then. But I really do want to clarify something that I think I left out in that initial announcement. I'm not going to stop podcasting. In fact, this very show is still going to be around. It's just going to change so much, pretty much from the ground up, that to me, it still garners a complete rebrand. So I want to properly end the existing version of this show before introducing the new version, along with the rest of the stuff I want to add to my content creation portfolio, so to speak. So, yeah, for the time being, expect a few more normal furry explained episodes throughout the first quarter of the year or so, and when the time comes for the change, I'll be sure to let you all know. Hopefully that clears some things up, and yeah, I'll see you guys next time.